Oh, page 31. And here the process is described for how the understanding of the Aramaic words that were found in the Gemara's manuscript were verified as accurate when rendered into English, and where that wasn't possible, the word was left in the original Aramaic. And in many cases, you know, it takes a whole paragraph to bring one Aramaic word into understanding. So a new process was developed to enhance the probability of conveying the Aramaic imagery into the imagery of the derivatives of the Sanskrit without wiping out the psychological understanding implicit in the Aramaic text. In order to explain this process, a clear understanding of the nature of language should be had. So language is first spoken before it's written, so that any language may be summarized as an organized grouping of sounds which permit thought transference between minds. And, you know, if you've done the workshop communication, did you hear what I think I said? You'll recognize the definition of communication here. That communication is the act of taking a construct that I have in my mind, a perceptual structure in my mind, and transferring it intact into your mind. And if you remember, if you listened to that workshop or you were part of it, you remember that I used to use the example of defining a word. We're talking language here. If you define a word as a tool of communication, and most anybody would agree that that's what a word is, if a word is a tool of communication, it obviously is indicative of an interaction between two. So right now I'm speaking words, you're listening. My words are cueing mental imagery, dynamics in your mind. And if the imagery connected in your mind matches the imagery connected in my mind, then we've got communication. I'm transferring intact what I have in my mind into your mind. But there's a problem with that. And that is that each one of us has a past. Now, if the definition of words as tools of communication makes sense to everybody, then notice that right now, there are words moving in your mind that I'm not speaking. They're tools of communication moving within your mind that are coming from me. And if words or tools of communication are indicative of an interaction between two, of course, the obvious question then becomes, well, who's in there with you? Who's telling you what the meaning of anything is? And you go back to the Course in Miracles. I have given this all the meaning it has for me. If I'm not living, and one of the objectives of this work is to live in actuality, not in perception. If I'm not living in actuality, then perception is a construct in my mind unique to me based upon what certain cueing sounds resonate in me. And this ties into the impact of speech all the way across the board. You know, we've talked about regulatory speech. And regulatory speech is literally the energetic pattern elicited by words that control literally cellular chemistry, perception, creative process, emotions. All of those things are controlled by words. Pretty important stuff. And so when you ask the question, who's in there with you? Or I ask that question, who's giving you the meaning of what my words are conveying? And the objective of the Institute when translating this was to come come as close as possible without the who's in there with you being in the way of communication. Sadly, many people use words or anything but communication. Sadly, many people use words to get what they want, to control others, to do all sorts of things other than communicate. When we step into the responsibility communication process, and we're moving away from projection communication with that tool. Projection communication is what? I have a reality structure in my mind, and I use words to try to convince you that you're responsible for that structure in my mind. That's projection communication. You know, if man is moving in me, the average person who is a card-carrying member of the One World Universal Religion of Blame says, you made me mad. So I'm now using words to try to convince somebody else that they're responsible for what's moving in me. And what we want to do is just pure communication. We want to take the imagery cued by certain words, Aramaic words, and make sure that the same imagery moves when the English words are used. So again, communication, thought transference between mind. I have a reality in my mind, and I want to transfer it intact to your mind. Thus, a language is, among other functions, a vehicle for transporting thoughts and concepts from one mind to another. For psychological studies of the mind, we find that the human mind is particularly adept at organizing complex thoughts or concepts so that they are keyed or cued by a particular sound, visual, or other sensory symbol. Perception of visual or auditory symbols to which thoughts or concepts have been keyed in a given mind causes that mind to perceive those thoughts or concepts. If, there's a big if here, if the mindset or attitude is proper. So, in order for, let's say, recognizing, we've talked before about the fact that there are basically three filters over intentions in the mind, three filters over the perception. Only one filter can be active at a time and then controlling at a time. And those three filters are fear, hostility, and rakma over intentions, fear, hostility, or kuba over perception. Each mindset or each filter determines which data that part of the mind can use in building or showing us what's moving. So if Rakma is active, then only units of intention, only information keyed to love can come to mind. Anything that is negative or destructive will be excluded. If fear is active, then love is excluded, the destructive is excluded, and what comes forward is the negative. If hostility is active, then the intentions that come to mind are destructive, and those which are loving or negative are excluded. So, one of the things that was recognized is that the mindset or attitude had to be proper. And when we hear Yeshua and they say, what's most important in the law? And going back to that 11 most important words ever spoken, what was he talking about? He didn't say to love God, love neighbor as yourself. He said to have rakma when you think of the Creator, when you think of neighbor, and by so doing, you maintain self. In other words, if that gateway is open, then the presence of love is active in you. for whatever is going on in the world. That means that the mindset is correct to get the most accurate meanings for what's going on in our world. Obviously, if the thoughts or concepts within a receiving mind are not keyed to sounds, the same as in the mind attempting to communicate with us by sound, there can be no communication. Nor can there be any complex joint effort by the bodies controlled by those minds. This point is illustrated in the story of the Tower of Babel. In the translation of the Kavoris manuscript, Foundation scholars were immediately confronted by the fact that they were attempting to set sound symbols, and there's a typo there, the word it shows is that, and it should be thoughts. So a correction, the word that in the fourth paragraph, second line toward the end, THAT apostrophe S should be thoughts. So scholars were confronted by the fact that they were attempting to set to sound symbols, thoughts, and concepts they did not know. Obviously, this was an utterly impossible task. I mean, think of, we talked the other day about the Beatitudes, and that the beginning term or word in Aramaic is a three-part word, tuvehun, that speaks of a latent neural structure, and a neural structure that in most people is unconscious. That neural structure which is implanted by the Creator to guide us to happiness and well-being, how to bring it out of this latent or unconscious state and bring it into activity. Try and get that out of Blessed Are They. And obviously there's going to be a problem. So in addition, each Foundation scholar respected the wisdom of Yeshua far more than his own or her own wisdom. However, each felt they should understand what was being written down. Thus, each scholar was embarrassed to realize that he must of necessity filter down the wisdom of the teachings of Yeshua to the level of wisdom which did not exceed his own if he were to understand his own language. Another contradiction impossible to resolve under standard translation practices. So the objective was to get the imagery, the perceptual imagery, to come to mind with a sound in English that would match that which came forward from the Aramaic. And of course, we've all confronted things, there's a whole movie out there called Lost in Translation. So in fact, it's more than just an effort at translation. So Dan, fortunately, was an attorney, and he had an answer. So to overcome these impossibilities, the wisdom of the ages was consulted on how to best determine the truth about that which we do not know or cannot know. In the profession of law, rules of evidence have evolved for many thousands of years with this very object as their motivation and their goal. Consulting the learned of that profession, Foundation scholars were informed that cross-examination was the only method developed in recorded history to permit those who do not know the truth to test the veracity of communication. With this in mind, the system was devised to permit Foundation scholars to cross-examine the meaning cued by English symbols, which had been substituted for the Aramaic symbols used by Yeshua in his teachings, in order to ascertain the veracity of the resulting English text. So that's a really important point, and I wonder if that arouses any thoughts or questions for anyone. So I'm going to pause for just a moment and see if anyone has a thought, question about that that keeps us on track with where we're going with this, but has any, is that coming across clearly enough that it makes sense for everyone? Hopefully, it does. And I'm sure Jeannie would be talking to me if there were a hand going up, so we'll continue. And again, at any point that you have a question or anywhere that support is needed, we're here to league offer that. Accuracy in the case of an English equivalent of the teachings of Yeshua was assumed to exist when the words in the English text triggered in the average English-trained mind reading the Aramaic text of the teachings of Yeshua. Of course, the Aramaic text of the Kabor's manuscript may not present the verbal symbolization of the thoughts and concepts of Yeshua of Nazareth as he himself symbolized them. However, it is a perfect certainty that no other language than Aramaic can symbolize them. Aramaic was the language of his home, of his childhood, of his teachings, of his listeners, of his language from the cross. It was the language of Abraham and the prophets. Indeed, Aramaic is a lingua franca of those who best taught the law behind the law. Back about, I'm not even sure now how long ago, 15 or so years ago, maybe a little more than then, we were in Fort Lauderdale, and there was a gentleman there that had been studying my work for quite some time, and he was a member of a synagogue in Fort Lauderdale, and he wanted to introduce this work through his rabbi to the synagogue. And I had a meeting with the rabbi, you know, wanted to meet me. I was invited to his home for tea. We sat down, he poured tea, and asked me what I did. And I started out telling him about the Kabor's manuscript and that we were working with 164 AD text in Aramaic. And he just got this big smile on his face. This guy was about 6'7". He was huge. He gets up from the table. I'm sitting there, and I mean, I'm not a small guy, but I feel minuscule beside him standing over me. He gets up from his seat, and he comes over, and I'd never had a schnozzle before, but he wraps his arms around and says, let me give you a schnozzle. Yes, you're welcome in our congregation if you're working with the Aramaic. That was the language of all of our wisdom keepers. And he said, the only thing I'm going to ask, if you come and present with your Christian leanings, is that you do not use the word Christ to my congregation, or I won't be welcome back in. There was such confusion around that term. But we ended up doing a week of workshops. We ended up doing adding an additional workshop, which we did at the Holocaust Museum in Fort Lauderdale. That was a pretty powerful experience, which put me into one of the deepest healing crises I've ever been in. So it was pretty intense. But it was really pretty nice verification when he didn't really need to know anything else about what I was presenting, except that it came out of the Aramaic. And of course, if you listen to the Greeks today, they'll tell you that, oh no, if you've ever watched the movie My Big Fat Greek Wedding, you'll remember the father is always talking about, yeah, and it was the Greeks that did it, and it was the Greeks, and it was the Greeks, and it was the Greeks. And they're still doing that with the Aramaic scriptures, which is just bizarre and crazy, claiming that they wrote it down and only they have the meanings. And the concepts and the meanings, the imagery triggered in a mind that comes from that Greek orientation is just woefully inadequate to even start to communicate what the Aramaic text communicates. So to throw open the work for cross-examination, the Aramaic text was first transliterated and transposed into phonics using the English alphabet. By this means, anyone could identify the recurrence of a sound symbol whenever it appeared. Underneath each separate sound symbol, the idea, thought, or concept triggered in the Aramaic was noted. Otherwise, not familiar with Aramaic, connected and reconnected to these ideas until the resulting English text was thought by bilingual scholars to trigger the same images and concepts as in the Aramaic. By the way, if you are listening and you don't have a copy of this text, you're welcome to order it. It can be ordered on our website from our catalog, And if you just order it nor as you might normally order something from our catalog, the catalog is set up in a way that it is automatic and it adds shipping to the process. Because we're doing this for this audience, what we've decided to do is we'll pick up the cost of shipping if you want to order the a copy of the manuscript of the Enlightenment book. And it's $25. We use PayPal for our orders to go through. And PayPal takes a percentage off the top of that, which is the equivalent of just a little bit more than a dollar. So if you decide you'd like to get a copy of this, if you go to our website, down at the bottom is a donate button. It goes through, as I say, PayPal. You don't have to have PayPal. You can use a credit card or whatever. If you've got PayPal, you can do that as well. But if you make a donation for $26 and put your name and address in, and then it's for Enlightenment, we'll pick up and pay the shipping. Just, you know, if you want a copy of this text that we're working with. For cross-examination, a postulate was established that each time an Aramaic word appeared within the same sermon or parable, it probably symbolized the same thought. Thus, if that same thought did not appear in the English text, each time the Aramaic word appeared in a given sermon or parable, a lack of textual veracity was suspected and received careful re-examination. For instance, in Matthew 19:24, the King James Version says, "And again, I say unto you, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God." The breakdown of the Aramaic text indicates this imagery is not supported by the Aramaic. There is no Aramaic word meaning to go in the verse, in the Aramaic language. The word gamla is frequently rendered camel's hair by some scholars in translating this verse from the Aramaic. The application of cross-examination technique described above shed doubt upon the accuracy of this rendering. Elsewhere in the Gospel of John the Baptist is said to have had a coat of camel's hair. The Aramaic word used for camel's hair in that passage was not the same word as gamla. Therefore, gamla apparently does not in this passage mean camel's hair. Further exploration of the images keyed by Aramaic words clarifies the meaning of the verse. At the time of Yeshua, Jerusalem was a walled city with heavy main gates. For night use, there was a small gate left open. It was so narrow, you know, it's like they were inhospitable people. They wouldn't leave somebody out in the wild and not allowing them to come in if they arrived at night. So there was a narrow gate, and one man could pass through that gate at a time, so you couldn't get an army in and attack the city. And a camel couldn't pass without difficulty, and while passing was severely confined and frustrated. And of course, a camel was generally used to carry a load. They were transport animals. So if you wanted to come into the city, you had to unload whatever the camel was carrying, and then you had to manipulate, force the camel through the gate, and then you had to carry whatever goods the camel was carrying through the gate. So this small night opening, which was shaped like a hole in a needle, was called kita, Aramaic for needle. Thus, it would appear that the images presented in this verse of the teachings of Yeshua involved a comparison between the difficulties of a camel confined within the narrow space within the night gate of Jerusalem, then known as the needle. A rich man confined within the narrow boundaries of the pathway into the kingdom of love, rather than presented rich with the inevitable doom, you know, rather than, you know, well, you're dead, buddy, because you're rich. It's just saying, and of course that was used to, you know, fleece people by those who had no integrity utilizing that that idea. But it did speak of the distraction of excessive amounts of wealth that would tend to detract someone from the work of Yeshua, which was the work of cleaning up one's own mind. In order to empower the reader to conduct his own cross-examination of the text, a limited glossary in concordance with the text is included. While the phonic spelling of Aramaic words does not conform to currently followed scholarship, it is felt to be sufficient for the purpose. Because of the use of this method and the employment of cross-examination as heretofore described, the resulting text may be said to have been generated, not translated. Images triggered for the Aramaic mind are approximated to a fair degree by the English text presented, with the exception of the few where the concept did not exist in Western thought, or excessive confusion was attached to the usual word. So some of the words are left untranslated, and then in the dictionary, the glossary at the back, there's an essay that gives a deeper explanation of why that word was left in, or an understanding of that word, or the symbology or the symbolism that was resonated in the mind by it in Aramaic. So when that difficulty arose, that symbol was left in the Aramaic sound, so as to indicate a new concept must be acquired if understanding is to be achieved. So wherever that happens, then, and basically, there are some select passages in this manuscript or in this text called the Enlightenment, and it follows the standard King James Version of the Bible, and the key words are left in brackets in Aramaic, and then you can go back into the text and do your own translation. It's a very powerful experience to do, to go through. So, this indicates that there are new ideas, new complex concepts that need to be acquired in order to garner any real understanding of what Yeshua was saying in so many cases. One cue or word left undisturbed is the Aramaic symbol nafsha, which appears in English and Greek texts as life, soul, or itself. This word is left in its original sound, for all attempts to change it into English symbolism failed. There was just no idea that you could speak in a word in Aramaic that would cue the same imagery as it would cue in the Aramaic mind. So this would be the new concept or the new mental construct that would have to be acquired in order to understand this word when it appeared in the text. So the word is a philosophy involving life, law, cognition, physical health, and the harmony of human actions and affairs with divine origin and active force. A whole big mouthful that doesn't come across with one word. There's no word curing that thought or concept or idea in Western culture, so it is left in its original dignity. An essay, considering its apparent meaning, appears in the glossary. Another symbol left in the original Aramaic sound is Ruka Dikutcha. Not because its literal meaning is not available, but because of the degree of theological conflict on the concept illustrated. The sound triggers the feminine third unit of the Trinity, denial of which leaves us in unforgiveness. You know, you take that one simple little concept and can you imagine how many people over the eons have suffered horrendously because in a fit of anger or what have you, they had done what they considered to be the denial of this idea which was rendered the Holy Spirit. Can you imagine how much suffering people have done by misunderstanding this over the last 2,000 years? When it doesn't say the denial of Ruach HaKodesh is the unforgivable sin, but rather that the denial of the existence of Ruach leaves us in unforgiveness, leaves us unable to process out the energy that is at the root of our trauma at any given moment. So it's not unforgivable, which leaves, you know, which creates a great opening for minds that are, that live in hostility and fear and condemnation to make for a beautiful fear trip around the scriptures, which sadly too many preachers have been doing for too long, in the name of a guy who brought a teaching based in love, which is pretty weird when you think about it. I remember I was up in Lansing, Michigan. This was way back in the early days I started traveling. So it's 41, 42 years ago. And I spoke for, I was invited to speak with people who was involved in my work, was a member of the Kiwanis Club. I was invited to speak at his Kiwanis meeting. And I did. And there was a man there who was a fundamentalist preacher who did the grace at the meal. And we were introduced, and you know, it was a cordial, nice, hi, how are you kind of thing. And afterwards, I asked him if we could talk, spend some time. And the conversation devolved into looking at the meaning of the Aramaic words of Yeshua in their original context. What did he actually say in Aramaic? And this guy who had been a preacher for 50 years, he'd been a fundamentalist preacher for 50 years, and he literally actually said to me, I don't care what Yeshua said. Well, he didn't use the word Yeshua, it was Jesus. Didn't even know his name. I don't care what he said. I got enough understanding out of my Greek texts. It's just mind-boggling. And there are just so many pieces to the puzzle that are such as this one, you know, changing the denial of this feminine elemental force in us that, by definition, undoes the effects of errors and teaches us the truth. Without the ability to accept that or to be in tune with that, then we're stuck with unforgiveness. We can't personally, individually move all of the underlying energetic patterns that go into one particular structure produced by the mind of some form of hostility or fear. Without this power, without being able to invite it into activity, without that willingness, then the energetic pattern doesn't move. We're stuck with it. So this is, as it's spoken of in Matthew 12:20-32. And so Ruach HaKodesh is described in John 4:23-24 as the entity which is part of the Creator and must be worshipped, loved, and trusted. And that comes down to emulated, you know, that idea of worship, as opposed to we're down on our hands and knees, an ancient idea, and under the full control of a deity where what love wants us to do, it would appear, listening to the Aramaic, is to emulate the behaviors that love would do. That would be a an accurate definition of the word worship. And we would change the word. You know, it's only been the last couple of years that it's gotten clear for me in doing this work that the word love is totally and completely misused. We've had lots of conversations about that in this culture, and that we are love. We don't do love. We can't love another. Another can't love us. We can be the presence of love with another. Another can be the presence of love for us. But turning that word, that symbol, into something that describes something we do rather than what we are denies who we are. And so the substitute word there in this passage that it's referring to in John 4:23-24 would be honored and trusted. So to honor, pay attention to, and be in harmony with the guidance from Rebbe. And it goes on to say, and this is that which breaks off the effects of error, teaches truth, and causes us to be mindful of the rules by which we should live and think. And we could probably change the word should there to we are designed there is a set of principles which keep us on track. You know, we talked earlier about the guardrails on the highway to reason. There are guardrails that keep the mind on track. And this is a power that will bring those things to mind if we are willing to honor it and trust it. With such great importance placed by Yeshua upon understanding Ruka Dikutcha, Foundation scholars felt it advisable to use the original Aramaic symbol. Ancient symbolic pictures from Egypt, South America, and elsewhere depict the use or action of four elemental forces in the creation of the universe and all that is therein. Man, augmenting his created sensory equipment with all manner of created devices, has yet to be able to sense or perceive any of these four forces or major energies, which are said to constitute the fundamental energies creative of the physical universe and life. In other words, we know there's gravity because we can observe it in operation. But while there are many theories about gravity, nobody knows what it is. Nobody's ever observed it. They've observed the effects of it, but they've never tasted it or touched it or smelled it or seen it. They have seen the effects of it, but not the thing itself. And so it is with these elemental forces. And it is the same with this elemental force called Ruka Dikutcha. If we were to break that term down again, it would be a feminine elemental force that undoes the effects of errors and teaches us the truth. And you can't know that force directly any more than you can gravity. However, you know, the fact that we've been able to observe gravity and we can trust that it works in certain ways, if we do trust it, then we can accomplish great things with gravity. And so it is with Ruka Dikutcha. If we are willing to acknowledge that by observation, we can see its effects, we can feel its effects, we will be the benefactor of its effects. And that then opens a space for us to be able to experience that elemental force in its fullness. So as an example, for instance, it's well known that stars are expanding outward at tremendous velocities from a central point of beginning, despite gravitational attraction, each for the other, which contradicts their outward rush. So we know we live in an expanding universe. You know, that this new Webb telescope that's out there now has shown us that, you know, it is an infinite quantity larger than what we thought. So some immense originating expulsive force or energy initiated your outward journey, and which still continues despite the tug of gravity that's gone on for billions of years. By the way, one of the other pieces of the puzzle that comes in here is to recognize that when we're talking about, many people are out there, you know, they want 7 24-hour days to be the creation. Even though the book that they're quoting from says to the creator, a day is like 1,000 years and 1,000 years is like a day. But no, we want the 7 24-hour days because that fits into a certain theological mindset, or maybe I should say a non-theological mindset that denies the truth. So we have this understanding that comes when we can observe the effects of something and begin to trust it. And so what we're trying to explain here is how we arrived at that. So man's created mind, using created constituents, has been unable to locate or contact such an initiating force. I mean, science has been looking for this thing. What's causing this expanding universe, this expulsion? What is it? We can observe the fact that it exists by observing the outward flight of the stars. After this originating expulsive force, the coalescence pressure of gravity, the gravity force, acted on the originally expulsed material, bringing the individual units together, and ultimately bringing together clouds of primordial hydrogen into the solidity of the stars and their planets. As with the expulsive force, the gravity force cannot be sensed directly by man's mind. All man can do is observe its effect and thus affirm its existence. A third force appears to operate in the physical area untouched by the sensing equipment of man. Something associated with heat appears to prevent the orbiting electron or free electron from joining the nucleus of the hydrogen atom, despite the pull of the opposite electrical charge. Somebody would say, what's this got to do with Aramaic in the scriptures? Well, what we're looking to do is to use the things we have been able to prove successfully and benefit from to make the leap to understanding those things which, because our sensory apparatus can't touch it, people deny it, people pretend it's not there, people won't interact with it. So as you understand how that's developed, it at least for me, it creates a space for, okay, so there's another elemental force that they were aware of in Aramaic, and even though nobody's ever been able to touch it, no scientist, you know, no scientist has ever touched gravity, but we use it and we know it's there. So perhaps that same force, third force that's being spoken of, lifted the electron out of an inert neutron so as to form hydrogen. If so, this force is the creator of chemistry and chemical reactions and the father of the planet and animal life. While undetected, there is no doubt as to the existence of this force, or no matter how low we cool hydrogen, or how many electrons we spray on it, or how much we squeeze it, the center proton refuses to accept an electron and remains hydrogen. The beginning unit of matter, as we know it, the first element in the periodic table of the elements. Again, man cannot directly contact this force, only sense its impact on the material world. Grucha stands for these three forces and various invisible. So the term Grucha speaks of these elemental forces. And then there's one that was specifically in Aramaic that was divined for man, Rukha Dikutcha. So this word Rukha in Aramaic stands for the elemental forces, gravity, etc. Invisible but material forces such as wind, magnetism, and electricity. As Rukha Dikutcha, it represents man's undetectable yet tangible force upon the mind of man, a force from the Creator, or that divinely intended for man, a fourth force, which man cannot directly contact, and cannot, as yet, cannot perceive fully to exist. So we're inviting a leap for those who can't imagine that such a force exists, to recognize that we're steeped in these forces all the time. We just assume. We assume we know something. What do you know about gravity? Nobody even knows what it is. Another symbol, and you can reason to its function because you can interact with it and see the results of it. If you will do that with Rukha Dikutcha, she who undoes the effects of errors and teaches us the truth, then you will be able to work with it on a conscious, consistent basis and watch the effects unfold. Another symbol left in the original Aramaic sound is kenuta, human behavior and judgment, which we would describe as just and fair. This is one of the items in the Beatitudes. It calls for just and fair behavior between people. But in Aramaic, just and fair behavior between people isn't enough. It's a much bigger idea. And again, as stated earlier, you have to acquire a new understanding in order to start to grasp what the Aramaic thought was. So justness is a slightly different concept in Western thought, being a finite measurable result or symptom, whereas kenuta is not only the result, but is also the cause behind the result. So this word, looking for just and fair behavior, means that an individual mind has to embrace not only the result of it, but that the cause is part of the process. Cause and effect in Aramaic are one. They're not separate. And so you're not just looking for just and fair behavior as a result, the expression of it, but you're looking for, in each case, with every idea that we're talking about here, we're looking to intimately connect you with what's behind the result, the cause of it. So kenuta is not only the result, but the cause behind the result. It is the judgment and behavior which produces justness, as well as the just judgment and behavior produced. So one needs to expand their definition from just looking at, because the mind can effort, you know, trying to produce a result, but because of its biases, it's oftentimes its results will be crazy. Selfish, self-centered. I came across let's see if I can just quickly find it here. Give me 1 second. Came across this yesterday. It was a statement from a court case. Just give me a second here to see if I can find it. Here it is. It goes back to a 1968 court case where the court handed down an opinion in a case against a tax protester, and what it said is, some people believe with great fervor preposterous things that just happen to coincide with their own self-interest. I thought that was a rather insightful thought. And, you know, it fits here in that recognizing that cause and effect are one. We're not just trying to acquire an effect. We're not just trying to make something happen in the world, but we're looking to connect with the unseen, invisible, not directly knowable cause of that result. So it expands, to me, it expands. And it's interesting, in the Aramaic language, the word kingdom of heaven can also be translated properly as the kingdom of expansion. So looking to expand into, connect this with the cause of this thing that would be called just and fair behavior, where a mind biased by its own self-interest would want to perhaps not do so much just and fair behavior, but rather do something that benefits itself. Another unique symbol in Aramaic is Kuba, K-H-O-O-B-A. And again, the misuse of the word love there. So this would be the filter or the mindset that we're told to have for our enemies. Concept to be cued by Kuba did not exist in Western thought until psychological advances uncovering the controlling force of a set of mind were discovered. This particular, just one second, I'm making note. So this filter is an attitude, a mindset, which includes the desire for all-embracing affection for the other, and the cue control site, which causes what is good about the other to be perceived. So this particular word relates to perception and the building of perception. And what we've finally come to understand is that it's a filter, much like we're talking about the filters over the intentional part of the brain, the frontal lobes of the brain, hostility, fear, rachma. We've got hostility, fear, and kuba. And you know, one of the things they asked Yeshua, I said, like, how do you tell where somebody's at? How do I even tell where I'm at? If I have an unconscious mind, how do I tell? And what he said is, you look at your fruit. One of the things that is the fruit is, what is your mind feeding you? That's the fruit of your life. And so if hostility, as opposed to kuba, if hostility is the active filter over the perceptual part of the mind, the back of the brain, that mind is going to be irritated at any object of attention it perceives while that filter is set. There's going to be irritation. So, if you've ever been in a relationship with someone and, you know, they've got rachma set with you, I cherish you, you're wonderful, and then all of a sudden the hostility filter comes up. Well, what happened? Why are you so irritated with me? What? Oh, I got it. You remember the one world universal religion of blame, and hostility is active in your mind, and whoever or whatever you look at, your irritation is going to be projected on them. Okay, I got it. But you can't get that out of the Greek texts, but out of the Aramaic, you can understand that. And then the other filter besides kuba is fear. And if fear is the active filter in the mind, the only constructs that mind can produce are those that are just ready to attack, because one is feeling threatened. So, hostility produces a perceptual construct based in something being interpreted as threatening about the object of attention. Fear means that the mind will perceive something as, or pardon me, irritating with the hostility filter, something threatening. Same object of attention. You know, how does a an adult abuse their precious child. If they look at that precious child through the hostility filter, then they will feel irritated. If they look at that child through the fear filter, then they will feel threatened. And what most people do when they're threatened is attack. If one understands there's a thing called GUBA and is committed to keeping those two filters, they are corresponding, interdependent, interrelated filters, RACMA over the frontal lobes of the brain, KUBA over the back of the brain, then we now have intentions that are key to love available as the raw material for our goals. Goals drive perception that engages the back of the brain where perception is stored, and now we have a quality of perception that is based in whatever filter is active.
You have a hand up.
Oh, great. Let's say hello.
Okay. I believe it's Joanne, 205. You're on the air.
Hello. I'll call next week to talk about this, but my question, Michael, is if healing my own mind also heals generational things that I inherited, can that work for another person? I started thinking about my children and their dad.
Hey, can you hold for just 1 second? Can you back that up just a little bit? Say that again.
Can I heal somebody like a former husband?
Well, here would be my take, is that if I do my work around an issue, I create an energetic space where the other, who is tied to that energy through resonance, can also heal. Can I heal them? I don't think I can directly demand, okay, now you're going to heal because I've done my work around this.
No. But
I can open the energy space for that to happen. And if they have the inclination to move through that, pardon me?
They not explain anymore, but it would work the same way for generational
freedom. Okay. Yes. I had an experience about, a little better than a year ago where I was doing a still point session. And as I was breathing, I'll make this quick because we're down to the last minute or so, but I was breathing. And as I was breathing, I was instructed to look downward. So I turned my eyes down, even though my eyes are closed. And I saw this huge field of darkness. It was just more expansive than I could even imagine. And in that field of darkness, there were an uncountable, an unfathomable number of lights, small lights. And I asked, what am I looking at here? And what I was told was that I was looking at the darkness that was surrounded and being carried by my ancestors. And that I was being asked if I would be willing to step in and help to process that energy.
Wow.
And so by holding that space, yes, I think you can assist in processing out the energy that keeps people in unconscious pain. And as you help to process that out, at the moment where they're willing to move, then they're going to move. I think that's exactly what was described. The next piece I got when I was doing that still point session was I understood what happened with Yeshua in the Garden of Gethsemane. Now, the fear-based mind turns that into something threatening and says, see, you drove in the nails. He had to take on your sins and suffer for them. As opposed to the truth of that situation in the garden was out of the presence of love and delight, he said, I can take on these energies and with the presence of my love, I can help to process this pain, this trauma out of the world. And each of us can step in beside him and do that, would be my take.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay, well, I'll call
That's what we're designed for.
Okay. Great.
Awesome. I'll look forward to talking to you again on Monday, dear heart. Blessings.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for using Blog Talk.